Blessed is the man whose delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. Lord, help us to do this. For Christ's sake. Amen. Well, I don't know what your hymn book you use in your churches, but I thought I'd quote a line or two from our hymn book. It's Graham Kendrick's fairly modern hymn. This is our God, the servant king. He calls us now to follow him, to bring our lives as a daily offering of worship to the servant king. Or Charles Wesley, O thou who camest from above the fire celestial to impart, kindle a flame of sacred love on the mean altar of my heart. Or this John Bunyan, I suppose this is the one I should be quoting here in a Baptist seminary. He who would true valour see, let him come hither. Or this even more militant one by George Duffield. Stand up for Jesus, ye soldiers of the cross. Lift high his royal banner, it must not suffer loss. From victory unto victory his army he shall lead, till every foe is vanquished and Christ is Lord indeed. Now when you think about it, these hymns are prayers set to music that God will work within us to make us what the hymn writer thinks we ought to be like. Graham Kendrick and Charles Wesley want us to offer ourselves to God completely as though we were a sacrifice. John Bunyan and George Duffield encourage us to fight for God against the world, the flesh and the devil. Through this poetry, these writers tell us how to act. Almost, they're being a bit more subtle in this, they're making us pray to act in this way. They're implicitly teaching us what to believe and how to behave. And sometimes we recognise this. One Sunday, on Easter Sunday a year or two ago, we went to the Channel Isles, which is an island near France, which actually belonged to Britain. Anyway, in this church in Jersey, they had a modern hymn book entitled Hymns Old and New. And, you know, as you're wont to do at a boring point in the sermon, or was it before the service? I skimmed the introduction. Anyway, and he explained that some ancient hymns were unsuitable for modern thought. Not just because they had these and thousands or anything like that. It was not just unfeminist ideas that the compilers disliked, but the militarism of some hymns. He had made the comment, we are concerned that the book should use positive and appropriate images, and decided that militarism and triumphalism were therefore not appropriate. And I'm sure he wouldn't have found He Who Would True Valour See in its old form there, or Stand Up for Jesus. But it did have the quasi-Buddhist lines, which the second most popular hymn in Britain has these lines in it. Breathe through the heats of our desire the coolness and thy balm. Let sense be dumb, let flesh retire, etc. You probably know that hymn. Anyway, and the start of the prayer of St. Francis, make me an instrument of thy peace, etc. Now, though I don't approve of the compiler's principles of selection, I think they're dead right to have noticed the teaching function of hymns, and indeed of liturgy in general. Years ago, when we were doing the course on early Christian doctrine, I was told this little Latin tag. Lex orandi, lex credendi is the line I was taught. What you pray is what you believe, roughly. And I was told a study of the Lord's Prayer may be just as informative about Christian doctrine, Christian theology, as, say, the much longer Apostles' Creed. For it's in prayer that people give utterance to their deepest and most fundamental convictions. Now, I've often told students, if you really want to discover what you care about, listen to yourself praying. It's in prayer that people give utterance to their deepest and most fundamental convictions. Thus, the words hymn writers and liturgists put on our lips in worship affect us profoundly. They teach us what to think and feel more effectively when they're put to music, so we can hum them to ourselves whenever we feel inclined. Now, particularly influential in this regard are the Psalms, which have been at the heart of Jewish and Christian worship for the best part of 3 millennia. They were first sung in the temple, then in the apostolic churches. The Psalms constituted the core dart of the monastic tradition on the one hand and the Reformed tradition on the other. It's a relatively recent phenomenon that hymns have displaced the Psalms as the mainspring of Christian worship. So if the lex orandi, lex credendi principle is correct, the Psalms must have had the most profound effect on Christian theology and ethics. But though the theology of the Psalms has often been discussed, I've noted very little work devoted to their ethics. For instance, two recent works on Old Testament ethics more or less overlook the contribution of the Psalms. The book in German by Eckhard Otto on the theological ethics of the Old Testament has just 13 references to the Psalms, compared with 40 to Proverbs and 78 to Deuteronomy, although the book of Psalms is about three times as long as Proverbs or Deuteronomy. And there's a similar disproportion in a British book by Cyril Rod, Glimpses of a Strange Land, Studies in Old Testament Ethics. Even the evangelical writer Christopher Wright, in his recent book, Old Testament Ethics for the People of God, has 50% more references to Deuteronomy than to the Psalms. Given the relative length of the two books, comments in Deuteronomy outweigh those on the Psalms 4-1. So I'm going to try in this lecture to remedy the neglect of the ethics of the Psalms. In it I shall explore the claim of the Psalms to teach ethics and how the Psalms do this by constantly contrasting the righteous, people whom God likes, with the wicked, those whom he hates. Now I shall ask how far the Psalms' picture of the righteous corresponds to the principles of behaviour enunciated in the Ten Commandments, which are emphasised, which are admitted. And I want to go on to discuss the idea of the imitation of God principle. You know, be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. But before I turn to some particular texts of the Psalms, I want to note a peculiarity of the Psalms that sets them apart from all other ethical texts in the Old Testament. The Psalms are meant to be recited or sung as prayers. That is, their public address to God. And the Psalms put powerful words into the worshipper's mouth. For there is no truth in their mouth. Their inmost soul is destruction. They flatter. Their throat is an open grave. They flatter with their tongue. Make them bear their guilt, O God. Let them fall by their own counsels. Because of the abundance of their transgressions, cast them out. For they have rebelled against you. Here the psalmist is accusing the wicked and summoning God to intervene against them. We have a similar scenario in Psalm 52. And Dorothy Arabella Custer has aptly described the scenario. These psalms distribute the roles of the actors so that I, the worshipper, those standing around, the righteous and wicked, and God stand simultaneously opposite each other. This involvement of the worship in expressing his assent to these sentiments makes the Psalms quite different from the other modes of teaching ethics in the Old Testament. And suppose one thinks of the Old Testament stories. They were presumably recited by storytellers within the family or in the tribes. They rarely make explicit their judgments on the actions that are recited, so the moral of the story might be missed, and certainly didn't have to be endorsed by the listeners. I mean, you could just ignore the story, like I suppose lots of people ignore the sermons that they listen to. The same is true of the laws. We don't know how they were passed on in Bible times. Few people would have had written copies of the law. Some texts suggest the Levites were involved in teaching the law. But once again, for the listener, the reception of the law was essentially passive. You listened to the law, maybe an explanation of it by a preacher, and then it was up to you to keep it or reject it as you saw fit. And as long as you didn't publicly reject it, or publicly break the law, you were okay, socially at least, anyway. Thus, receiving the ethical teaching of the law, or the history books of the Old Testament, was basically a silent, passive affair. But reciting the Psalms is quite different. The prayer of the Psalms is taking these words on his lips and saying them to God in a personal and solemn way. Take Psalm 7 again. The Lord judges the peoples. Judge me, O Lord, according to my righteousness, and according to the integrity that is in me. O let the evil of the wicked come to an end, and may you establish the righteous, you who test the minds and hearts, O righteous God. The psalmist is affirming that God will judge all the peoples, but then invites God to judge him, despite affirming that God tests the minds and the hearts. I mean to say, it's rather a challenging and disturbing prayer. Would you like to pray that? Do we really want God to test our innermost motives, I wonder? But time and again in the Psalms, we meet this sort of prayer. The reciter or singer of the Psalms is thus involved in giving very active assent to the standards of life implied in the Psalms. I think the closest analogy in Scripture I've found to this affirmation of standards is in Deuteronomy 27. There, in a ceremony to be performed shortly after entering the Promised Land, all the tribes stand before the Lord, before the Levites, who then pronounce curses on certain types of behavior, mostly secret sins. For example, cursed be the man who makes a carved or cast metal image and sets it up in secret. Cursed be anyone who dishonors his father or his mother. Cursed be anyone who misleads a blind man on the road. That's what the Levites say. They read out these curses, and after each curse, we're told, all the people shall answer and say, Amen. But even saying Amen to a curse seems to me semi-passive when compared with reciting a psalm. When you pray a psalm, you're describing the actions you will take and what you will avoid. It's almost like taking an oath or making a vow. The key words in a marriage ceremony are spoken publicly and to God. I, A, take you, B, to be my wedded wife, to have and to hold from this day forward, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and health, to love and to cherish, till death us do part. And later on there are words as rings are exchanged. With this ring I thee wed, with my body I thee worship, and with all my worldly goods I thee endow, in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost. One trusts that brides and grooms pronounce these words after careful thought beforehand and with complete sincerity on the big day. Because the words themselves transform their status. They become man and wife. Thus the words are performative. It seems to me that praying the Psalms is also a performative action. Saying these solemn words alters one's relationship in a way that mere listening does not. It's almost analogous, it seems to me, what St. Paul says about the importance of confession in Romans 10. He says there, because if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. For with the heart one believes and is justified, and with the mouth one confesses and is saved. Throughout the Psalms, one is confessing that God is Lord. And as the Psalms often insist, this is supposed to be a confession that comes from a pure and sincere heart. It's certainly salvation that the psalmist seeks. Time and again, he pleads to God to save him, to deliver him, to hear his prayer, and so on. Whether this always occurs or not is not my purpose to discuss now. I simply want to draw out some of the similarities between taking an oath, making a vow, confessing faith, and praying the Psalms. I think these parallels may help us to see how powerful the commitment is that the Psalms make of their user. In praying the Psalms, one is actively committing oneself to following the God-approved life. So what is the God-approved lifestyle that the Psalms encourage us to pursue? Psalm 1 invites the reader to meditate on the law day and night. Careful examination of the Psalms suggests that the law the psalmist had in mind is not just the law of Moses, but the Psalter itself, which probably has been deliberately divided into 5 books to mimic the Pentateuch. That the law is so important is underlined by the presence of Psalm 119, the longest psalm of the Psalter, with its repeated refrain, teach me your statutes, and similar prayers about the law, the way of your statutes, and so on. While some commentators have noted these phenomena, there's been a tendency to downplay them, ascribing them to a later wisdom redactor, who, because he is alleged to be late, is ipso facto unimportant. In this paper, I want to start to remedy this neglect by drawing out the pervasiveness of ethical concern in the Psalter and making a preliminary evaluation of its potential for Old Testament ethics. Now, I should like to say that this is an area where I found very little writing before. The topic is rarely touched on in works of Old Testament ethics, and basically people just discuss the entrance liturgies as Psalms 15 and 24, the imprecatory Psalms, or the ideals of kingship in Psalm 72. So I'm now sort of going to launch out and take you in ways that I haven't actually borrowed from other people, as I have in most of the other lectures I've given to you. So, if the Ten Commandments are the quintessence of biblical ethics, it might be appropriate to start by seeing when and where they are alluded to. Are there any direct quotes? Which topics in the Decalogue, idolatry, theft, etc., are most often mentioned in the Psalms, and which are omitted? From an examination of the rules endorsed by the Psalms, we should turn to the lifestyle they commend. What should the righteous be like? How may their character be defined in terms of virtues, and what are the typical vices of the wicked? We should also note that the Psalms are first and foremost prayers, so they constantly bring God into the picture, not least in their ethical statements. God's character is constantly appealed to as the guarantor of the ethical system. He will ensure that the wicked are punished and the righteous are rewarded. But more than that, God's actions are often seen as a model for human behavior. His care for the downtrodden and oppressed, his hatred of duplicity, should inspire all his human subjects in their attitudes to others. So, let's begin with the Ten Commandments. Though the law in general, see Psalms 1, 19 and 19, where have we got to here? Though the law in general and individual laws in particular are so important in the Psalter, it's surprising how rarely the law giving at Sinai is mentioned. In fact, in the long Psalms reciting Israel's history, it's usually omitted. In fact, it's only mentioned twice in Psalm 68 and Psalm 106. But though the law giving may not be mentioned at the most appropriate place in the historical sequence, it's clearly presupposed, so Psalm 78 essentially demonstrating how Israel has persistently neglected the law they were given and told to teach their children, says, "He has established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel which he commanded our fathers to teach to their children." Sounds very like Deuteronomy to me. Similarly, though Psalm 105 says nothing about the law giving in its historical review, it ends, "And he gave them the lands of the nations, and they took possession of the fruit of the people's toils, that they may keep his statutes and observe his laws." So the reviews of Israel's past are designed to produce a sense of gratitude and therefore willingness to observe the law. Now, there is a much shorter history psalm, Psalm 81, which not only quotes the prologue to the Ten Commandments, "I am the Lord your God who brought you up out of the land of Egypt," but it also paraphrases the first two commandments, "There shall be no strange God among you. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not bow down to them or serve them." The second commandment, banning idolatry, is reaffirmed strongly as well. Psalm 24 asks, "Who shall ascend the hill of the Lord, and who shall stand in his holy place?" And the reply is, "He who has clean hands and a pure heart, who does not lift up his soul to what is false, and does not swear deceitfully." What is false is usually supposed to be in a reference to idolatry. But elsewhere in the Psalms, there's no mistaking the robust assault on adultery in the Psalms. Take Psalm 115, it's parallel 135. Why should the nations say, "Where is their God? Our God is in the heavens. He does all that he pleases. Their idols are silver and gold, the work of human hands. They have mouths but do not speak, eyes but do not see. They have ears but do not hear," and so on. "Those who make them become like them, so do all who trust in them." Psalm 31 sums up the attitude of the Psalter. "I hate those who pay regard to worthless idols, but I trust in the Lord." The third commandment, "You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain," is not directly quoted in the Psalms unless 24:4 is an allusion to it, but the proper use of his name is frequently celebrated. Psalm 8 is devoted to this topic: "O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth." Other typical sentiments in the Psalms are like, "Let them praise your great and awesome name, holy is he." The Psalms underline the importance of the proper use of the name by illustrating how it ought to be used, not by banning its misuse. If God's name were honoured in this way, the way that the Psalms do, there'd be no question of taking it in vain. The only commandment that seems to be totally ignored in the Psalms is the Sabbath. Remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. There is only one Psalm 92 whose heading is a song for the Sabbath. Psalm 81 urges, "Blow up the trumpet and the new moon at the full moon on our feast day," but nowhere else is there a mention of the obligation to remember the Sabbath. It's very surprising when Genesis 1 is setting out the normativeness of the Sabbath, I think, but still. And I really can't understand why it shouldn't have got mentioned. Is it because the psalmist didn't care about it? Could it be presupposed that the worshippers using the Psalms is reciting them on the Sabbath? If you've got an answer to this question, I'd be glad to hear it later. Honour your father and mother. Is another commandment that at first sight does not seem to matter in the Psalms. However, the gift of children and the privilege of parenthood is very much celebrated in the Psalter, not to mention the land promise. Just as the name of God is celebrated in the Psalms rather than condemning its profanation, so the Psalms celebrate the family dimension of life. God is the archetypal father. This in itself implies that earthly fathers should be honoured. "He shall cry to me, 'You are my father, my God, and the rock of my salvation,'" and so on. God's blessing is shown in the gift of children, Psalm 127 and 128. If the fourth and fifth commandments are relatively underplayed in the Psalter, the prohibition of murder is quite frequently alluded to, even if some remarks don't apply literal killing so much as depriving someone of his livelihood. Enemies are compared to savage lions or dogs rending their prey, or bulls, or to a highwayman who watches for the righteous and seeks to put him to death. The wicked also kill the widow and the sojourner and murder the fatherless. These accusations are mostly embedded in the laments, pleas to God to prevent or avenge such crimes. Adultery is only mentioned once explicitly in the Psalms, Psalm 50. "To the wicked God says, 'What right do you have to take my statutes or take my covenant on your lips? For you hate discipline and you cast my words behind you. If you see a thief, you are pleased with him. You keep company with adulterers.'" The context of the condemnation of adultery, a rejection of God's statutes, covenant and words, and the string of offences, theft, adultery and false witness, make it clear that the psalmist is consciously recalling the Ten Commandments here. Now, although this is the only explicit reference to adultery in the Psalter, it stands next to Psalm 51, the most moving of all the penitential psalms, which has the title, "To the Choirmaster, a Psalm of David, when Nathan the prophet went to him after he had gone to Bathsheba." It begins, "Have mercy on me, O God, according to your steadfast love, according to your abundant mercy, blot out my transgressions." Now, whatever may be the origin of the psalm and its heading, Psalm 51 I'm talking about, and we've already noticed this morning I was telling you all the problems that Mr. Senger had with it. Anyway, well, whatever may be the origin of the psalm and its heading, readings which take seriously the canonical sequence of the psalms and their headings cannot fail to observe what a powerful statement Psalm 51 is about the sin of adultery. Theft and coveting are also frequently bemoaned in the Psalms. We've already noted the string of theft, adultery and lying in Psalm 50, but stealing, especially from the poor, is condemned elsewhere. The wicked lurks in ambush like a lion in his thicket. He lurks that he may seize the poor. He seizes the poor when he drives him into the net. "Because the poor are plundered, because the needy groan, I will now arise, says the Lord." And so on. There's quite a lot of passages which go on about that. But of all the sins in the Decalogue, it's surely the ninth which receives the fullest treatment. "You shall not bear false witness against your neighbour." Verse after verse after verse condemns the misuse of the tongue. "O men, how long shall my honour be turned into shame? How long will you love vain words and turn seek after lies?" Next, that was Psalm 4. Psalm 5. "You destroy those who speak lies. The Lord abhors bloodthirsty and deceitful men." Psalm 10. "His mouth is filled with cursing and deceit and oppression. Under his tongue are mischief and deceit." Psalm 12. "Everyone utters lies to his neighbour with flattering lips and double heart they speak." If we read all the quotes that there are about misuse of the tongue, I would exhaust my time, so we better go on. The abundance of passages on this topic surprised me, though of course you must be aware that the misuse of the tongue is very much a theme of such wisdom books as Proverbs and James in the New Testament. So far I've just tried to show how the Psalter supports the principles of the Decalogue. This is, I think, only one string to its ethical bow. Indeed, I think secondary to its chief approach in presenting ethics, which is through the description of the good and the wicked. Or in Hebrew terminology, the righteous and the wicked. Good, tov in Hebrew, is rarely used of human character. They usually talk about tzaddik, righteous. So we talk about the two ways of the righteous and the wicked, and they're contrasted in the very first psalm. "Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his way law he delights day and night." Then we are told, he's like a tree, but the wicked are like chaff which the wind drives away. Basically, Psalm 1 is telling us there are two types of people, two types of life, two conclusions. Which will you choose to follow is the question posed by Psalm 1. Its own answer is clear. But the following psalms develop this contrast between the wicked and righteous very fully. Time and time again, the psalms declare the righteous enjoy God's favour. He answers their prayers, delivers them from the plots of the wicked. A portrait of the righteous describes their deeds and their ultimate vindication. The righteous flourish like the palm tree and grow like a cedar in Lebanon. They are planted in the house of the Lord. They flourish in the courts of our God. They still bear fruits in old age. They are ever full of sap and green. To declare that the Lord is righteous. He is my rock, and there is no unrighteousness in him. But what characterized the righteous besides meditating on the law and dissociating himself from the wicked? Psalm 112 gives you quite a good picture. "Blessed is the man who fears the Lord, who greatly delights in his commandments. He is gracious, merciful, and righteous. The man who deals generously and lends and conducts his affairs with justice. He is not afraid of bad news. His heart is firm, trusting in the Lord. His heart is steady. He will not be afraid till he looks in triumph on his enemies. He has distributed freely. He has given to the poor. His righteousness endures forever. His horn is exalted in honor." Though study of the law is one aspect of the righteous person's character, this passage also highlights his trust in God, fear of the Lord, his confidence in God. Also his generosity, he deals generously and lends, he is distributed freely and given to the poor. The wicked, on the other hand, are the converse of the righteous. The psalm emphasized that they will ultimately perish. In the short term, the wicked may appear to flourish, but that's misleading. And Psalm 73 tells you all about that, which ends, "Truly, you set the wicked in slippery places. You make them fall to ruin. How are they destroyed in a moment, swept away utterly by terrors?" The wicked are the converse of the righteous. Whereas the righteous fear God, the wicked mock him. Whereas the righteous are generous to the poor, the wicked exploit the poor, impoverishing them further. The wicked borrows but does not pay back, but the righteous is generous and gives, and so on. The wicked pays lip service to God's law but does not practice. He is boastful, scheming, and bears grudges. So, we'll go on, see. The righteous and the wicked, there we are, God. Now, the Psalms are direct address to God. They're prayers of faith expressing the psalmist's conviction that God reigns, that he is the ultimate judge. Even the laments which start in despair end in hope. The kingship psalms, 93 to 100, which celebrate the fact that the Lord reigns, often end with the affirmation that God will judge the earth, and this is a cause of celebration. Let the heavens be glad and the earth rejoice. Let the sea roar and all that fills in it. Let the field exult and everything in it. Then shall all the trees of the forest sing for joy before the Lord, for he comes to judge the earth. You know, I never used to like that bit of the psalm, the bit that he's coming to judge the earth. It's rarely our reaction to the thought of God coming in judgment, but it recurs frequently throughout the Psalter. But there's a splendid book that changed my mind on this. It's by Eric Zenger, A God... I haven't written it down here, sorry. A God of Vengeance, A must-read book for all theological students, I would say. Anyway, Zenger, A God of Vengeance, has pointed out that the belief that God will be the universal judge is a message of hope in a world of oppression and injustice. I say that again. The hope that God is going to be the universal judge is a message for a world of oppression and justice. There's hope in that situation. The Psalms look forward to both the universal judgment, but also to particular, more immediate judgment of the wicked and their activities. As said, Psalm 1:6 declares the way of the wicked will perish. Psalm 2, the kings of the earth plot against the Lord and his anointed, but the Lord will dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Psalm 3 affirms that you break the teeth of the wicked. Psalm 5 affirms that you destroy those who speak lies. I mean, sometimes we are a bit squeamish about this, I think. It sounds like nasty vindictiveness. Schadenfreude, celebrating your enemies suffering their comeuppance. But if you look at the situation through the eye of the sufferers, you might feel that this is an over-harsh judgment. Commenting on one of the harshest imprecatory psalms, McCann, in that book that I recommended this morning, A Theological Introduction to the Book of the Psalms, he says this: Psalm 109 not only tells us like it is with us, but it also tells us how it is with the world. The psalmist has been victimized, and when people become victims, they're bound to react with rage. When people are treated unjustly, we can expect them to lash out. We can expect them to express vehemently the desire for an end to the violence that has made them a victim. So there's that aspect to it. If you are suffering and you can't do anything about it, the longer you live in life, the more fine things you'll find unfair as life goes on. What can you do about it except pray to God to put the situation right? And that's what these psalms are doing. But Let's be careful. We could see these remarks as making a moral statement to the person uttering them, in a more subtler fashion than some of the hymns I quoted at the beginning. If someone rejoices in the fact that God will dash the wicked in pieces like a potter's vessel, he is implicitly putting himself firmly on God's side and committing himself not to do anything that will put him on the class of the wicked. The moral implication of reciting these remarks about divine judgment are thus immense. And I think one can see this illustrated in Psalm 139. No, one of the most wonderful psalms, isn't it? Psalm 139. Celebrating God's complete and intimate care of the psalmist. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from afar. The psalmist goes on to reflect on God's love for him throughout his life, wherever he's been. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. If I were to count them, they're more than the sand. If I awake, I awake and I am still with you. Now, most of us would like the psalm to end there, and some people cut the psalm off at that point. Unfortunately, it goes on. Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God. O men of blood, depart from me. Do not I hate those who hate you, O Lord. But to rejoice in God's judgment on sin is to turn the spotlight on one's own life and behaviour. Will I pass muster with God? So the psalm ends, Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts, and see if there be any grievous way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. I mean, we pray the Lord's Prayer, Thy kingdom come, Thy will be done. We in a sort of quiet and tepid way put ourselves on God's side. But in the Psalms, there's no tepidity. You're really hot on God's side. And it scares us. In many ways, though, not in all, the righteous are supposed to imitate God. Who himself is often called righteous. God is the one who is the righteous judge. He intervenes to save the oppressed, something the righteous should do if they can. God raises the poor from the dust and lifts the needy from the ash heap to make them sit with the princes of his people. He gives the barren woman a home, making her the joyous mother of children. Whilst those in the best position to promote righteousness are the kings, and they're called on to exercise godlike qualities of justice. They give the king your justice, O God, and your righteousness to the royal son. May he judge your people with righteousness and your poor with justice. May he defend the cause of the poor of the people, give deliverance to the children of the needy, and crush the oppressor. In Psalm 101, King David promises that he will indeed act in a godly way and insists that all his servants will have to meet God's standards. He insists on integrity, loyalty, no backbiting or arrogance, and so on. He who walks in the way that is blameless shall minister to me. No one who practices deceit shall dwell in my house. No one who utters lies shall continue before my eyes. Morning by morning I will destroy all the wicked in the land, cutting off all the evildoers from the city of the Lord. But perhaps the most striking proof of the importance of this idea of imitating God as a principle of psalmic ethics is found in the twin psalms of 111 and 112. Both are acrostic psalms, that is, each half verse begins with a new letter of the Hebrew alphabet. You know, Psalm 119 is a acrostic psalm. You have eight verses each with the same letter of the alphabet. But here we have two consecutive acrostic psalms, the first describing the righteousness of God and the second the righteous man. And it's striking the way the characters of the righteous man seem to echo those of God. There are many similar ideas in the corresponding lines of each verse. The greatness of God's deeds in 111:2 is echoed in the mighty offspring of the righteous, the Hebrew of 111:3a rhymes with 112:3a. But most striking of all are three descriptions of God in 111 that apply to the righteous man. in Psalm 112. His righteousness endures forever. That's repeated twice in 112. The second could be seen as a variation on 111:10. His praise endures forever. And then, the Lord is gracious and merciful in 111:4. His matches 112:4. He is gracious, merciful, and righteous. These verbal parallels surely indicate that the editors held that the character of the righteous should reflect the character of God. So I just want to end by looking at one particular characteristic which I think is so central in these psalmic virtues. Steadfast love is probably the central aspect of God's character as it's delineated in the Psalms. The Hebrew word is chesed. It gets translated in various different ways in different versions. Mercy or love. Steadfast love is the ESV as well as the RSV. Now, it's interesting that of 245 occurrences of the word chesed in the Old Testament, over half, 127 in fact, are found in the Psalter. If we are right that human virtues should reflect the divine, we may expect it to be encouraged in man. But first let us define it briefly. Psalm 103:2-4 perhaps offers the best summary. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and forget not all his benefits, who forgives all your iniquities, who heals all your diseases, who redeems your life from the pit, who crowns you with steadfast love and mercy. Chesed is that divine quality that's behind all of God's benevolence, his creation, his forgiveness of sins, his healing and life. Psalm 136 has rather a monotonous refrain. His steadfast love endures forever. But actually it sums up God's saving activity through the Pentateuch as chesed. It's demonstrated in his creation, in the Exodus, the wilderness wanderings, the victories in Transjordan and Canaan, and in his ongoing support for his people. God's chesed is particularly manifest when he answers prayer, which is a theme of 107. He brings wanderers home when they cry to him, forgives repentant rebels, heals those at death's door, rescues drowning soldiers. All these acts of kindness are triggered by human prayers, but demonstrate God's character of chesed. But it's back in Psalm 103 that the episode which most reveals what God's chesed is like. The allusion in Psalm 103 is to Exodus 34, where the Lord passed before Moses and proclaimed, the Lord, a God, merciful and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, and so on. In fact, if you know Exodus 34, that's when the golden calf had been made, and God had threatened to destroy Israel until Moses prayed. And the incidence of the golden calf was resolved through God's chesed. In response to Moses' prayer, appealing to God's promises, Israel was spared from annihilation and allowed to proceed to the promised land. Psalm 103 brings out the special quality of chesed. He made known his ways to Moses, his acts to the people of Israel. The Lord is merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love. He will not always chide, nor will he keep his anger forever. For as high as the heavens are above the earth, so great is his steadfast love towards those who fear him. As far as the east is from the west, so far does he remove our transgressions from us. Chesed, steadfast love, is more than kindness. It's an element of reliability and dependability. It's a trait that's a permanent feature of God's character. There's a sense of grace about God's willingness to forgive. Yahweh has decided in favor of Israel. He has promised life, care, alleviation of distress and preservation. Indeed, he has filled the whole earth with his kindness. He has thus granted fellowship with him to his people, to all mankind, to the whole world. And this act, like the promise and assurance of future help and fellowship, is characterized by permanency, constancy, and reliability. Now, if God's character is so focused in this chesed, shouldn't it also be central to human behavior as well? Now, I was a bit surprised when I read the Psalms. It's surprising. He rarely predicated of human beings. Example, exception is Psalm 109:16, which says, "He did not remember to show kindness, but pursued the poor and needy and brokenhearted to put them to death." Because this man failed to show hesed, the psalmist prays that he will not experience hesed himself. Let there be none to extend kindness to him. Outside the Psalms, there are numerous passages which show that chesed is a basic human virtue. For example, Proverbs 3, "Let not steadfast love and faithfulness forsake you." Indeed, Proverbs 16 almost equates chesed with the fear of God. By steadfast and faithfulness, iniquity is atoned for, and by the fear of God, one turns away from evil. So why should it be hardly mentioned as a human virtue in the Psalms? I suggest, in fact, that it is, that the word chassid is the adjective derived from chesed, and may be translated the one who practices chesed. And this term is even more characteristically concentrated in the Psalms than even the noun chesed is. Chassid occurs 25 times in the Psalms, out of a total of 32 times in the whole Old Testament. And we miss it because English translations are quite random in the way they translate it. They don't consistently translate chassid by the same term. You get it sometimes merciful, saint, godly, faithful, honed, kind, holy. Such a variety of translations for just 25 passages means it's easy to overlook. Once the term applies to God in the Psalms, the Lord is righteous in all his work and kind, chassid in all his works. Another significant passage connecting divine and human expressions of chassid is Psalm 18:25. "With the merciful, as with the chassid, you show yourself merciful. With the blameless man, you show yourself blameless." This passage not only suggests the reciprocal relationship between man and God, but suggests that man's behavior ought to reflect God's. Its continuation shows more of the moral dimensions of being a chassid. "With the purified you show yourself pure, and with the crooked you make yourself seem tortuous." But usually this moral dimension is understood rather than expressed. Most often the chassid are involved in worship, usually songing along with others, but sometimes on their beds, Psalm 147. They're in covenant with God. They're contrasted with the wicked. They're those who wait for the Lord and trust in him. So, that's where we come to our end today. And I hope this brief introduction to the ethics of the Psalms will have convinced you that actually the Psalter is very important in any discussion of Old Testament ethics. Partly because of the unique quality that when you actually have to say these words yourself, you're committing yourself in a much stronger way than just listening to the Ten Commandments or listening to a story or whatever. But I think there's also a lot more in these passages that needs working out and developing. So it's just a sort of work in progress, this paper. I'm hoping that I can develop it into a book sometime, but I better not make too many rash promises, because then you ask me when it's coming out, so I don't know when that'll be. But anyway, I hope that's given you some new thoughts about the Psalms. I'll be ready to try and answer any questions that you may have. Can anybody tell me why the Sabbath is not mentioned in the Psalms? You're not going to ask me questions, I'm going to ask you the questions.
I haven't thought of this, any reference to the cultic laws that, other than the Sabbath, that separate, you know, Jews from Gentiles, typically in the Psalms? You mentioned again you know, typically moral issues, but the food laws, are those sort of things mentioned?
You have sacrifices quite a lot. A lot of mention of sacrifice, or by implication of sacrifice, paying vows and things like that. But the interesting thing about the Sabbath is that it's set in Genesis 1, which is therefore showing you God's ideals for the whole of humanity. It's not just a particular Jewish law. And when you actually get to the laws in Leviticus and Exodus, etc., I mean, it's one of the laws that the immigrants, the non-Jews, are meant to keep. The gerim are supposed to keep these. Even your cattle and your slaves have got to keep the Sabbath. It's very interesting. It's a universal principle that's being set out, I think, in the Old Testament. But somehow it's not mentioned. But it's also parallel to the New Testament, which doesn't seem to make much of the Sabbath either. But anyway, obviously, if anybody has a little idea on solving this problem for me,
I don't know, but Deuteronomy does not do much with the Sabbath outside the Decalogue. I think nothing.
No, except that Deuteronomy seems to be arranged in order of the Decalogue, the various laws, and you have a large section about festivals, which would come at the right point in the sequence.
But the explicit command, the Decalogue, looks like sort of an addendum to Deuteronomy, doesn't it?
Yes.
So I don't know if that has to do with Psalms or not.
Yes.
I have no idea.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Somebody over there, yeah?
I've not studied the Psalms very much, I'm too young, but I know there's a couple allusions to creation and the deliverance of Exodus, and there's a connection to, you know, the Sabbath, to those two things. Is there any psalm that when it alludes to the creation or the deliverance out of Egypt that might have the allusion there to the Sabbath?
Well, I mean, that's Deuteronomy connects it with the Exodus, and Exodus connects it with creation. So you might be right that if you're looking at those sort of things, one could see it implied rather than made explicit. I mean, the trouble is, when you have silence in the Bible, is it because it's taken for granted, or it's not known? You know, you can go both ways on the silences, and that seems to be the problem.
I don't remember which one it is, but I think it's like Psalm 70 or 72 that alludes to the power of God splitting the waters. And it was a long time back, but I heard a professor talking about allusions there to the sabbatical year, but not necessarily to the Sabbath day. So that's the best I can give you, but I don't remember.
Good. Oh, well, I'm trying to think about them. Thank you very much.
It may be something, in fact. The Pentateuch does not give very much specific about actual cultic practices, you know, what you do. For example, if you have a 7 or 8 day festival, what did you do on those days? It never tells you. It doesn't give you a program.
It tells you which sacrifices had to be offered in the temple.
Yeah, it gives you that sacrifice list, but not much else.
Yes, that's right.
So it seems to assume that a lot of knowledge of what you do in worship is known in tradition.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
It might be that the Sabbath is assumed to be such. I don't know. But that,
I mean, what you're saying, that the laity's duties on these holy days is not spelled out in the Bible.
Not spelled out, no.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, right. It's not spelled out. You know, so what do they do when they come to worship for 7 days and sit around and twiddle their thumbs or sing hymns or what? I mean, what do they do?
We aren't
told what they did, you know.
Yeah, you're right.
Of course, all kind of people try to fill it in, as you well know. But
That is very relevant observation.
Well,
No. I was wondering if you are aware of any specific contributions that the Psalms make to New Testament ethics. Old Testament ethics. You've said they're often overlooked and mentioned. You know, the the active versus passive power, are there any distinct contributions that are made there, or is it just the personal nature of...
Well, I mean, St. Paul uses the Psalms quite a lot. I went to ETS last November, and Richard Hayes was talking about his recent book on... I can't remember what it was. You'll know what it was. Can't remember what it was anyway, and it was quite interesting. He was trying to use just, he was omitting to use the Psalms, which I then obviously the sort of New Testament mindset and sort of thing, you look for the ethical dimensions by looking at the only certain parts. But you know, when you read St. Paul, he quotes the Psalms quite a lot as for ethical teaching. I haven't got those details at my fingertips, but I was quite struck by that. So I think, you know, they are important for New Testament ethics, but perhaps not have been exploited in, at least they didn't seem to be exploited by Dr. Hayes, which I actually thought he should have done. I think they were.
Well, on the subject of ethics and the Psalms, just to ask you the basic seminary student question, what do you do in your lectures as you're dealing with these issues with the ethical problems such as Psalm 137, the smashing the infants on the rocks and that sort of thing? How do you draw that into the ethical world of the Psalms?
Well, I gave you a little hint of when we were discussing Psalm 139. I think the two most useful things on it are McCann's book, A Theological Introduction to the Book of the Psalms, and Zenger's book. Zenger has a wonderful bit about the importance of judgment, because he tells the story, which is borrowed from somebody else, of an East German who had been a concentration camp guard, and no, he hadn't been a concentration camp guard. He had been in a platoon that had overrun a French village and massacred the inhabitants. And when he was arrested and tried, he was asked if he'd never regretted what he'd done. And he said he never realized he'd done anything wrong until the day of, you know, he'd been called up to court. And he points out in this book how throughout the world there are people who are suffering oppression who can do nothing about it. And they are praying to God to help them. And the prayers that you get in the Psalms are prayers that God will act rather than that I should react. So he says they are breaking the circle of vengeance because you are praying to God that he will act. You find in Revelation, you know, the martyrs praying, avenge our blood, to God. That's in heaven they're doing that. And that really what we are looking for and do believe in is a God who is ultimately fair, who will make things, the great injustices of the world, right ultimately. And McCann says, you know, if you don't feel this way, he says, it's perhaps because you have never been, you never had to suffer yourself. And he says we should pray these prayers. Even if you haven't suffered yourself this way and felt this way, you should pray them on behalf of the world that has suffered and is suffering. I mean, I take the Barnabas Fund magazine, and they have a daily prayer diary, you know, and practically every day there's some catastrophic persecution mentioned of Christians in some part of the world or other. More often in the Muslim world than elsewhere, but in India and China as well as the Muslim world. You know, and you just... just doesn't bear thinking about, really, if you put your foot in, put yourself in these people's shoes. And I think the Psalms give us a way of empathizing and bringing their needs to God. But it's very interesting. I mean, they're not the two writers of the books that I've suggested to you, McCann and Zenger, are not your typical hardline evangelical like I was brought up to be. One is a Catholic who was Zenger. He was he's not only professor of theology but is a Benedictine monk. And the reason he wrote his book was that under Vatican II regulations they were no longer reciting the whole Psalms or all the Psalms, but certain ones were getting cut out. And his book is written to say that, you know, this is most unsatisfactory because you're taking away the hope of the oppressed by doing this. And the other book by McCann in some ways a fairly liberal Presbyterian, because when I read this book I didn't realize quite at the time, but he never refers to God as he, because when he should have said himself, God himself, he gets God self or something like that. That's the only thing that gave it away to me. But you know, these are the people, and people like Brueggemann, who see this, you know, these the needs of the world that we should be caring and praying for them. And so I think that's what we ought to be doing.